This morning, we're continuing our study on anxiety, discouragement, despair, and difficulty, and hope in that. And ultimately, we have a hope in Jesus. And so last week, we looked at, if you missed it, what can I say but that you missed it? Last week, we looked at the 9 appeals against anxiety and worry, and the notes. We have some notes still on the table. If you missed that, you should take your notes home with you and listen to that message and fill it out. What Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6 about how to deal with anxiety is for certain the longest treatment of anxiety in God's word, from Jesus' mouth. How do we deal with anxiety? I don't want to re-preach that message. I will just in general say this again, in the event that you have not been here, that we believe that anxiety is a very real thing. We said it in week one when we were looking at Peter's discussion about anxiety, that anxiety is real. It's as real as a roaring lion. And sometimes it feels like that. It feels like anxiety can take hold of us. But we learned that humility and understanding God in his proper place is important as a framework to understand how to deal with anxiety. So once we understand God in his place, we're able to say, as Peter exhorts us, cast your anxieties on him. Cast your cares on him, because he, I love this play on words, I believe the King James does it, cast your cares on him because he cares for you. Fundamentally we understand something about God, that God loves you, that he's stronger than you. And so we build on that last week, 9 exhortations. If God provides for sparrows, then he provides, and he clothes the lilies of the field that are temporal, and one day they're clothed in radiant splendor, but the next they're cast into a fire to be burned. Understand that if God cares for lilies that way, God cares for you. And ultimately, last week we recognized that worry doesn't solve anything, that you can worry about tomorrow, but that doesn't do anything. God will have grace sufficient for your tomorrow. There's nothing that worrying accomplishes, but understand this, God's grace will cover tomorrow's troubles. And so today I want to attack this from a different angle this morning. I want to just look at difficulty, because I understand that despair, difficulty, suffering leads to anxiety. And so how do you ultimately deal with suffering? How do you deal with the mental anguish of knowing I've lost everything, or my health isn't good, or my children are wayward from God? How do you deal with suffering? My children are sick. How do you deal with suffering? And what does suffering mean? How does difficulty play into the Christian life? So this morning, I want to attack that by inviting you to the book of Job, where I think that we'll see something about a suffering Job. And I love this passage of Scripture. But before we look into Job, if you have your notes in front of you, just an encouragement here, as we did last week, do not. This is not, again, what's the name of the game where you try to guess the words? The Wheel of Fortune. This is not Wheel of Fortune. You don't have to guess what it is. I'll tell you. Don't go ahead. Oh, so I think what Jesse's going to say is, Kelly, I said that last week, but really Kelly is the one that does that. She says, I hate them because I start trying to fill it out. So don't worry about it. It will get filled out. Do not worry about filling it out. I don't want to say this before we read. How many recognize that suffering is everywhere? Suffering is everywhere. Everybody suffers. You cannot turn on the television. We were watching football yesterday to be interrupted by news of another mass shooting in which there are people now in Texas that are suffering. And we recognize that in a world where their suffering is everywhere, we also live in a world in a Christianity that doesn't know how to deal with suffering. Because not just because Christianity is fond today of a blessing mentality, and I'm for blessing, right? I want blessing just like you do. But this idea that God exists to make you happy. And the idea that God exists for you, that the idea that God wants you to be blessed, healthy, wealthy, and wise, that idea that's popular in Christianity today, I think that's folly. God and it puts man center of the relationship between God and man, and man's not the center. God's the center. God exists for God. God exists for His glory, and we exist for God's glory, not the other way around. God does not exist for you. And so we have a problem with dealing with suffering because Christianity has a problem with it and has a wrong view of suffering and blessing. But additionally, we live in a culture. Do you have water? We live in a culture where. Where nobody wants to suffer. We live in a culture where everybody gets a trophy. Okay, but that's not helpful. Some people don't win. Sometimes things aren't fair. Sometimes people cheat. Sometimes people get ahead. Sometimes you're second place or third place or fourth place. And in a culture where we try to make sure everybody gets a trophy, in a culture where we try to reduce suffering, Christians have trouble with suffering. And so I think it's a Christian worldview is the problem. We live in a culture where we don't teach our young people how to deal with difficulty. Listen, difficulties. Job himself, does he not say that the moment you leave the womb, you're full of trouble? This is the nature of humanity. It's the nature of the fall. The moment Adam decided to sin against God, suffering entered the world. It's inescapable. It's inescapable. So Job chapter 1, I think, deals with this. Job chapter 1, chapter 2. And I want to fill in one blank before a couple blanks here by way of background. The book of Job is about, this is important, the book of Job is about the value, write that down, the value of God. The book challenges the idea, challenges the notion, the premise that God has no value in himself. Worth someone's devotion. Did you get all that? The book of Job is about the value of God. The book challenges the idea that God has no value in himself worth someone's devotion. So when we read this book, and we read chapter 1, chapter 2, the idea that God has value in himself, that God, by virtue of being God, is valuable. Right? That apart from everything else in your life, God has value. All right? This is the big picture of the book of Job, and it's important as we read moving forward. So now, let's go. You're familiar with the book of Job. But we're going to read chapter 1. We're going to read to verse 12, and then we're going to make a few observations here. There was a man in the land of Uz, whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. Four characteristics: blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. So, in other words, he's the best of all of those alive in the world. Job mastered these things above everybody else. He was blameless, upright, fearing God, and he turned away from evil. There was no failures in Job's life for God to punish. There was nothing in his life that God would consider a fault, that God would, according to the author, bring about as a fault. He was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. And that's important because he's about to go through difficulties, and it's important to understand that this man is upright and he's blameless. He had seven sons and three daughters that were born to him. His possessions also were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of all men of the East. Okay, so again, little resume. He's very wealthy. He's basically, who's the wealthiest man alive? Jeff Bezos. He's Jeff Bezos, right? The guy that owns Amazon. Okay, this guy is very wealthy and upright before God. His sons used to go, in verse 4, and hold a feast in the house of each one of his in his day. And they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. When the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Okay, so the kids would party and they meet occasionally. They were a close household, and Job would make offering to God on their behalf, just in the event that they weren't righteous like he was. So he cared for their spiritual well-being. Verse 6, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them." Satan means accuser. Just so that we understand, in the Old Testament, that word literally means the accuser. So Satan, the accuser, came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there's no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, Does Job fear God for nothing? It's another way of saying for no reason. Does Job have any reason to fear God? Is there any reason for in Job's life for Job to question God in any way? Because notice, have you not made a hedge about him? In other words, you've protected Job. He's got no concerns. Of course Job is fine before you. Of course he's got no reason to question God, because you've taken every difficulty from Job. All right. And so you put a hedge of protection around him and his house and all that he has on every side. You've blessed the works of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. So in other words, you've given him everything. He's got everything. Listen, God, mess with Job's stuff. Mess with the value of what he has, and Job will curse you to your face. You following that logic? And then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. All right, let's fill in some observations before we continue. And so I'm going to make some observations about what we just read. Important observations, but I don't want to center on these, but I do just want to observe some things about suffering. The enemy wants to destroy you. But I think this is important because lest you think that your suffering is happenstance, and we'll get into this in a little while, understand that there is an enemy, that if you're honoring God in the way that God would honor you, if that's the kind of life that you're going to live, Satan wants to destroy your life. Does that make sense? He might not want to mess with you if you're not living for God. But if you're living for God, I can tell you, Satan has an interest to destroy you. And so we look at suffering and say, oh, look at all this suffering. Understand, it may be spiritual. And so that's why I've made this big point about saying, you know, people say, well, dealing with anxiety is not predominantly spiritually. What are we talking about? A lot of the cause of the reason why you're anxious may be spiritually brought about. How can we divorce a spiritual solution to what might be a spiritual problem? So in other words, the enemy may have a hand in some of your difficulties. We have to at least be honest that's a possibility. And we can say this with certainty. The enemy wants to destroy your life. Indeed, I think that if you're very comfortable in your life, it's possible that you're not living for God in a way that's got the enemy's attention. And so observation number one, then the enemy wants to destroy you. If you don't believe that, then you've got fundamental problems with this whole series. Because again, we believe at the core of this are spiritual dimensions that we might not understand. Paul says we war not against flesh and blood, but we war against principalities and powers. The things that we don't understand. The enemy is absolutely a part of this potentially. Observation number two: our difficulties may not be because of failure. Our difficulties may not be because of failure, but to confirm our faith. Our difficulties may not be because of failures, but to confirm our faith. We see that here. He was upright and righteous, and the difficulties were not because of moral failure. I talk to people, it seems like every week, people ask me, why is God? Why am I going through this? To be honest, I have no idea. But it might just be that the enemy is trying to destroy you, which is just might just be that. But that it's there for your benefit to confirm our faith. And observation number three: God will not. Well, this is obvious. God will not allow testing that we cannot endure. A New Testament principle, no question. There's nothing that you can go through that you cannot endure. Okay. So back to the story. Job, now the enemy has permission from God to test Job with his stuff, right? And notice what happens now. And again, now you have to keep in mind the background of the book. The book is about the value of God. And basically, Job is about to be tested in such a way that Satan thinks that Job does not see value in God, that Job sees more value in his stuff. Are you following that? The whole thing here is that Satan believes that if you just take away his stuff, Job is going to curse you to your face. Job is more interested in the stuff that he has than he is interested in you. To take away his stuff, and all of Job's value system is wrapped up in the world, is wrapped up in his stuff. God, he doesn't see great value in God in himself. Is everybody following that? This is key, important, I think, to understanding Job and this principle. Verse 13. Now, on the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked. And they took them, and they also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." So the Sabaeans attacked all the livestock, the oxen and the donkeys. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell. And scholars believe that this is lightning. It's a lightning storm that potentially... So the fire of God came and fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, The Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and your daughters, they were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house. And it fell on the young people and they died. And alone I escaped to tell you. And so in one day, in one 20-minute time frame, four different people come to Job, and the Sabaeans come and they destroy the sheep and the oxen. The lightning comes and destroys the donkeys. The Chaldeans come and destroy more servants. And then finally a wind comes and destroys their family. And so Job is left with nothing. Nothing. I just, again, to pose a question. How many of you are dealing with anything in your life that is causing you anxiety? Because again, I think that kind of suffering, for me, would immediately launch me into panic attacks and anxiety. How many in this room are dealing with anything remotely like Job at this point? And notice the response, though, verse 20. Then Job arose, and he tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground, and he worshiped. And I think in my Bible, I've got that sort of mark there, a response, worship. As opposed to cursing God, as opposed to anxiety, grief, absolutely. He tore his clothes. He's low, and this is a picture he tore his robe, he shaved his head, and he fell to the ground. I can't get lower than this. This is devastating. There's nothing worse than what has happened to me. This is as low as it gets. This is the picture that's being painted, right? Definitely grief, absolutely. Difficulty and despair and suffering. Grief. That's natural, and that's an appropriate response with worship. With worship. And notice then our point number one, how to respond to difficulty. How to respond to difficulty. Worship. Point number one, worship. As opposed to cursing God, as Satan thought, he's going to curse you. He's going to curse you. He's going to curse you to your face. He's going to deny you to your face. Go ahead and take everything that Job has from you, from Job. And the moment that you do, Job is going to respond by saying to God, "I curse you." Now he doesn't curse God. Suffering doesn't mean that you get to curse God. It's an opportunity for worship. It's an opportunity for worship. And I want to put it in these terms. Job expressed God's worth. The next blank. Job expressed God's worth. In other words, there's still value in God. In other words, take everything away from me. Take away my family. Take away my livelihood. Take away everything that I have. My house. Take everything away from me, and I still can look at God and worship Him, and still look at God and say, "There's value there. That's the thing I'm living for. It doesn't matter what else happens in the world around me. God God is valuable. This is so important as a light bulb for me, because again, when I'm going through anxiety, the first step to going through anxiety is something happens, or I know that something's about to happen that is going to be a trial in some way. Are you following me? In other words, this doesn't happen, right? My anxiety just doesn't happen. My anxiety is born out of some difficulty. And it might be a difficulty for tomorrow. It might be a difficulty from yesterday. It might be a difficulty for today. But that difficulty gets me into a place where I start being anxious. Okay, so the problem is, how do I deal with the difficulty? So there's dealing with the anxiety. How do I deal with the difficulty? How do I look at that? How do I respond to difficulty? What's the appropriate response when I'm going through something very difficult? Worship. 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 Notice the value in God. Notice that everything else could burn to the ground, and God is still in my life. God is valuable. I'm going to worship. I recognize the value of God. I worship God. And notice his words. He says, he said, verse 21, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Notice this, blessed be the name of the Lord. Okay, I have a recognition that in difficulty, even difficulty that is profound, I would say that if this happened to most of us, we're talking about despair. This would be a moment of despair. How can I live the rest of my life knowing that my kids are dead? Everything that I've got is gone. All my livelihood is gone. I've got nothing left. Okay, that's a total moment to despair and to panic. In my mind, right? Like if this happened to me, like, okay, why aren't we all despairing? This seems like the appropriate time to despair. This seems like the appropriate time to have anxiety. No, it's not. It's the appropriate time to get your mind off of your circumstances and look to a God that still has value in the middle of your circumstances. God is valuable, and he's worthy. And in that moment, rather than be fixated in your problems, get fixated on God right away. God, I worship you. You're worthy to be praised. You're blessed today. Is everybody following that? This is one of those moments. We've said it a couple times already, that part of dealing with anxiety I have learned, and part of dealing with difficulty I'm learning is that you have to preach to yourself. You have to preach to yourself. You have to remind yourself. Next week, we're going to get into that out of Psalms a little bit more. This is so important, this principle. But there's an idea that you have to talk to yourself, not in like this weird kind of way, but like schizophrenic, weird kind of way. But I'm saying self, God is still in my life, and God is still valuable. God is more valuable. I haven't lost relative to who Jesus is, relative to the value of Christ. I've lost nothing. So you're preaching to yourself in the sense that you're keeping things in its proper perspective. So point number one, worship, as opposed to cursing God, as Satan thought, Job expressed God's worth. Satan thought that Job valued stuff more than God, that he didn't see the value in God. But difficulty tends to push us into God. Okay, God, I've lost everything, but God is still worthy. God is still worthy of my worship. This is one I'm going to start practicing for myself when difficulties come and when anxiety comes. Self, worship God. I'm saying that doesn't mean turn on the worship music that you have on your iPad worship list. On my phone, I've got an iPhone and I've got iTunes and one. I sleep to a couple different. I sleep to two different sound, three different, what do you call it on iTunes? Playlist. I go to sleep to three different ones, and the one I hit the most is this one that I call, that I've got titled Instrumental Worship, and it's just piano and instrumental hymns, and that's what I sleep to. And I also sleep to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. I sleep to that sometimes, but mostly it's instrumental worship. I'm not talking about putting on your playlist. I'm talking about noticing who God is and noticing his worth and taking value for yourself from the worth that God has in your life. That's what I mean by worship. Saying, God, you give, you take away, but you are blessed. You are worthy of my worship today. Above all my circumstances, there's nothing more valuable than you. Are you following that? This is key. I think this is key. It's key to Job. It's key to understanding anxiety. It's key to understanding how to deal with despair and difficulty. Okay. Point number two, let's go ahead and fill this out. Point number two, recognize that God owns everything. Everything is his. Everything is his. Notice what he says, naked I came in from my mother's womb, verse 21, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The Lord gave me my children and he took them away. The Lord gave me, my livestock. He took it away. The Lord gave me, my house. He took it away. Everything is God's. Hey, listen, God does no one anything bad. God doesn't do anything wrong to anybody if he takes everything away from you. God doesn't do you any wrong by taking away everything that you have because he gave you everything. And so if he takes it away, God didn't do anything that is any different than how you came into the world, because you came in with nothing. And so if God takes away your health, hey, listen, God doesn't owe you your health. He gave it to you. So if he takes it away, God hasn't done you anything wrong to you to take away what doesn't belong to you. And that might sound very harsh, but we must come to a realistic understanding. We did it last year when we talked about stewardship. God owns everything. Remember that? Well, it also, that principle, that stewardship principle, comes into play here. Okay, so that means when God takes everything away, I don't need to panic because God that's God's to begin with. God takes away my health. God takes away my house. God takes away my children. Those aren't your children. Those aren't your children. They're God's children. God owns everything. And so there's a sense in which we're putting God in his place, authoritative, and dealing with suffering means that we understand the same thing Job understands. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I'll return there. One day when you die, you get to take nothing with you. It's very interesting how much this played into our adult Bible fellowship in the sanctuary this week. It's profound. This sermon, how closely it relates to chapter 7 of the book that we're going through in adult Bible fellowship in the sanctuary. You don't own anything, and God doesn't owe you anything. And God is not hurting you or doing anything bad to you to take away from you what you previously didn't own. Recognize that God owns everything. Listen, if we live that way, just this point alone, if you had a deep sense that everything in your life was God's, your health, your children, your livelihood. If you really believe that, then when it goes away, there would be nothing to panic about. How many are tracking with that logic? That is precisely what Job is doing here. He's preaching to himself that, you know, after all, I didn't own any of that stuff. It's all God's. And at the end of the day, whether or not he took it away, one day when I die, I ain't taking it with me. Amen? So he preaches to himself. He worships. Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. But guess what? The Lord can take away and still not, God, how could you do this to me? Blessed be the name of the Lord. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Point number three. This one you're not going to like as much. This one's going to be tough. There may be a sense in which some of you potentially are going to reject some of this just sort of as a gut check. But we have to contend with it. Recognize, number three, recognize that God is sovereign. Recognize that God is sovereign. He is sovereign over Satan and over your possessions. Recognize that God is sovereign. This one is very difficult. And I want to prove this because we must understand it. Satan, okay, let's go back. Satan goes to God and said, let me mess with this stuff. Let me mess with this stuff. Okay, remember this? Satan goes to God and says, let me mess with this stuff. And then God says, okay, you can mess with this stuff, but recognize, but he says, don't mess with his life. In other words, his life is off limits. Don't mess with his life. You can mess with his stuff. Don't mess with his life. So when we leave that picture, the next thing we read is that the Sabaeans come, the strong wind comes, the lightning, the Chaldeans come. And you know what Job does? You know what Job does? There's something interesting. So our temptation is to say that, like we've already said, that the enemy wants to destroy us. There's no question about that. But notice the perspective that Job has. Job says, notice in verse 21, he says, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Well, hold on. I thought the Lord didn't play a role here. I thought this was the enemy doing this. But here Job is saying that the Lord did it. How does this make any sense? And the thing is, there are some scholars that when they see that, no, Job's theology is wrong. Job's theology is wrong. He doesn't understand. God didn't have anything to do with those difficulties. Even though I would challenge that idea on the grounds that a lot of what happened, the winds and the lightning, the enemy doesn't control nature. God does. And so I challenge that from the passage, that it seems like God has some sovereignty here, even over Satan, to accomplish what Satan does. But God's ultimately in charge. God ultimately is sovereign. And so that when he said the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, you might say, well, hold on, he misunderstands. The enemy was ultimately in charge. No. The enemy's not in charge here. God's in charge. God's in charge. And verse 22 clarifies it in case we don't understand it. Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. So in his analysis, in the way that he viewed circumstances, when he said the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, he was not sinning or inaccurate in saying that. He understood something here about the sovereignty of God. Okay, now God's ultimately in charge, but he's not blaming God. He's not cursing God for what he did. He's worshiping God. He's still giving God value and worth, But he recognizes that ultimately God is in charge. God is sovereign over our life, over our circumstances, over Satan. So even the extent to which God gave Satan the ability to go and do things to hurt Job, ultimately God was sovereign over Satan to allow what Satan did in such a way that Job recognizes the sovereignty of God in this. How many are following that? This is absolutely critical. Now, I found if there's anything that I need you to understand today, it's this above everything else. There's two things, big picture things. God is worthy. God is valuable. God is valuable. Okay? God is valuable. And whatever else happens in your life, if you still have God, it is well with your soul. Everything's fine. Okay? Because God is with you, and God has more value than anything else on this planet that you could amass as possessions. God is more valuable than all the joy that your family brings you, than all the joy that your kids bring you. God is infinitely more valuable than all of that. And so if it all goes away, God is valuable. And number two, God is sovereign. God is sovereign. He knows what is happening. And to some extent, he's intimately involved in your life. If we live, if you, and we talked about this in Sunday school, if you live your life and you view your circumstances, if you view the health issue that you have, if you view your circumstances with your kids, if you view the circumstances you have with your finances, if you view those things as just, oh, that stuff just happens. If you view that as happenstance, as stuff just happens, then you'll never see God and his hand in your life. The moment that you begin to see God intimately involved in your life, in a way that Romans 8, I love Romans 8. I think there's a translation issue in Romans 8 that kind of ties into this, a New Testament principle that ties into what I'm trying to say about the sovereignty of God. I'll just turn there. But all things work together for good. How many know that passage? All things work together for good to those that love God. Let me see. Romans 8. Somebody help me. All things work together for good to those that love God, to those that are the called according to his purpose. 28. Okay. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good for those who love God. Now, the King James says this. I typically don't do this, but it's important. King James says this, for we know that all things work together for good to those that love God. That's King James. For we know that all things work together for good. As if the things just work together for good. And I'm not very fond of that translation because it takes, I'm fonder of the New American Standard here, which puts God into a causality. For we know that God causes all things. Well, now that makes some people uncomfortable. You mean that God kind of has some responsibility for all the things that happen in my life, good and bad? I think so. And so, well, that doesn't seem very nice of God. Well, see, it doesn't, but you didn't own anything. None of it's yours. So God's not doing, that's why point number two is so important. God's not doing anything against you because none of it's yours. God is sovereign. I'm firmly convinced that in my own life, my bad theology in this area that would dictate that things just happen, oh, circumstance of life. I've said that so many times. Oh, that's just circumstance of life. Well, I'm going to be more careful about how I say that. Maybe circumstances of life, just kind of dismissing my circumstances as things that just happen, maybe that's not helpful. Maybe the thing is recognize that God has some play in this in such a way that puts God back into the picture. And again, I told you, you may have difficulty with this particular sermon point, but I challenge you with it. There's a point at which you're going to have to deal with God's sovereignty and the scope of God's sovereignty in your life. What does that mean? That God is sovereign, that God has, that God is king over what happens. What does that mean? To what extent is God sovereign? You have to wrestle with that. I think Job is teaching us that God's sovereignty extends into our difficulties. I'll just leave that with you. You'll have to wrestle with that for your own life. But I think Job seems to make it clear God is sovereign even to the extent that he impacts some of our difficulties. God is sovereign. He's sovereign over Satan, over things. And I just want to point out the same thing, chapter 2, where God, in chapter 1, Job values God above his possessions. This is next blank. In chapter 1, Job values God above his possessions. In chapter 2, he values God above his life. So remember, the enemy comes back. The enemy comes back to God and says, okay, that didn't work the first time. The possessions thing, I get it. He values you, but now let me attack his life. He'll curse you to your face if you let me attack his life. Let me do that and you'll see. And so God allows Satan another go at it. And here's the first time in verse 7 of chapter 2 where Satan gets, definitely for the author says, and Satan went out from there, from the presence of the Lord, and smote Job. This is the first time in chapter 1 and chapter 2 where Satan seems to be playing a direct hand in what is happening. So he smote Job with sore boils, okay, from head to foot. Verse 8, chapter 2. And he took a potsherd, a piece of pottery, and he began to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Verse 9. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Are you still holding on to this God thing? Why don't you curse God and die? Very interesting that in the original language, that word for curse is the same word. I found this extremely interesting. It's the same word that's found in verse 21, chapter 1, blessed be the name of the Lord. The same word for curse is the same word for blessed. And so from a point of view of this wife, she's saying, why don't you bless God now? Bless God then, if that's what you're going to do, and die, because God's not behind you in any way. A God that would allow you to lose everything, and now your body is being tormented with these boils. Why don't you bless God now and die? Notice verse 10. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Notice this. We talk about the sovereignty of God. Please notice Job's words. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? And notice again that the writer of the book clarifies that his theology is not wrong. In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Point number 4, and we're done. And I'm so sorry to have gone so long this morning. Doesn't feel like long. See, now you're like, what time is it? Don't worry. Don't worry. Recognize it is foolishness to give up on God in times of despair. God should be our treasure. God should be our treasure. What does the wife say? Give up on God. You're in despair. What's God done for you? And Job calls that foolish. Job calls it foolish. He said, you sound like one of the foolish women do. I want to just close by saying this. We don't have time to deal with it. In this book, everybody's putting everything away, which is good. That's fine. But this is important. The book, if you know the book, is basically the next 20 chapters, is a book, is a story in which three different friends go to Job and try to tell Job, you're going through this because. And I just made a mental note while I was preparing this, just a note that I have here, that there is a suffering that counsel doesn't help. There is a kind of suffering that advice doesn't help. There is a kind of anxiety and suffering that all the good advice doesn't help. And that kind of suffering does exactly what Job does. That kind of suffering takes you to the only place that you can help. When you're in that kind of despair, understand the answer is not getting rid of God and dispatching from God. The answer is go to the only thing you have left because God is going to be there. And I find it so interesting that at the end of the book, the way this book concludes is God telling Job, listen, where were you? It's so famous. It's a beautiful, beautiful chapter. Job is asked by God because Job, even though he starts off the book very good, by the end of the book, he's starting to question everything. I would say mostly because of a lot of bad advice that Job gets from a whole bunch of poor friends that are poor in their theology. Okay, but besides that, Job at the end goes to God, and he's throwing up his hands, he starts accusing God, and God says this. God says something very interesting. He says, listen, where were you when I laid the foundations of the world? Where were you when there nothing was in existence and I start speaking the world in existence? Where were you then? Because you have a lot of advice, Job, about the way that I should do things. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the world? Understand, there is despair that brings you to the place where you just have to recognize God is in control. God is valuable and he's in control. And that's all you have left. And there's no other advice that can be given. You just have to come to the place that you understand God is in control. He is sovereign, even over your poor circumstances. God is sovereign. And when you're left with just God, that ain't the worst thing because God has value. Because God is more valuable than anything you're about to lose, anything that you fear to lose. That anxiety, so, oh my gosh, my kids, I'm going to lose my peace about this. I'm going to lose financially. We're going to be in ruin. My health, my this, my that. Listen, God's, but you have God. It's okay. You have God. It's okay. Don't panic. You have God. It's okay. God is there. I trust, if nothing else, hear that this morning. Let's recognize the sovereignty of God and his value. And I think that is key to understanding suffering.